welcome to Orphaned Entertainment, the podcast dedicated to public domain media. I am Lord Christopher, and with me, the Lady Lydia.
Good Lord, indeed.
How are you, Lydia?
You know, I'm doing all right.
Good.
How are you, Lord Christopher?
I'm doing all right. Yeah, I'm all right. Yeah, nothing much to report, I guess.
Life is normal.
Yeah.
Not a whole lot of new movies going out of copyright this week. So.
No, unfortunately not.
We don't have very many updates for our listeners, but.
No. But I do want to, speaking of that, though, something that came up, it was someone that asked me a question. Not offline, but.
They asked you a question.
Yeah, someone asked me a question through Facebook, message, email, whatever it was. They were just asking about how we go about choosing the films, and then, of course, how do we verify that they are indeed public domain. So I thought I would address that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, what you really want to know is that we are very, very careful about all this. The way that we go about picking is we basically close our eyes and point. And wherever, usually there's an actor involved or a director involved that, you know, piques our interest.
We have a long list of films that we do have that is in public domain, and we'll go through and we'll find the title, and we'll just look for a title that interests us. We'll find a synopsis that interests us. Then we, you know, like Lydia said, an actor or a director or something, and just something that piques our interest. The thing I did want to point out is, for the most part, we haven't seen most of these films before we decide to review them. I don't know about, I can't speak for Lydia in all cases, but for the most part, the first time I watch these films is when I watch them for the podcast.
I think I've made one or two recommendations. I know, and then There Were None was one that, you know, I pounced on as soon as I found out that it was out of copyright. But for the most part, that is accurate. And then of course, what did we watch? Road to Bali.
Right.
So some of them we've seen, you know, either long ago or maybe our favorites, but definitely most of the films that we see, we pick kind of not at random exactly, but because they pique our interest.
Yeah. I think, once or twice we've chosen a film and then I've sat down to watch it and went, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I have seen this before.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I do try my best to verify that it is in public domain. I look for multiple sources that, declare it as public domain. I do try to weed myself through the U.S. copyright website to see if there's any copyright holdings on anything. So that's just a little backstory, little information about how we choose. And I just wanted to make people aware that we don't, for the most part, watch the films prior to us talking about it. And I think that kind of makes it sort of fun. It'd be easy to go through and pick a bunch of films that, oh, we've seen that. That'll be great. Mm-hmm. It kind of makes it more fun. It's a little bit more of a mystery and a kind of an exciting adventure, I think, for me anyway, the fact that I haven't seen any of these films before.
I definitely agree. To me, you can always sit down and watch your favorites over and over, but to see something that you really haven't seen and you know, think about how it impacts you as you're watching it and think about the actors. And I mean, to really kind of delve into it, it's unique. Usually when I'm watching a film, it's just for entertainment, but watching something new and trying to really pay attention to it, it's a different experience.
Yep. Very much. Another thing I wanted to mention, I wanted to talk about before we get into the film, is something that happened on our Facebook page. And it made me really happy. One of the likers, I don't know what you call them, members of our Facebook group.
Followers.
Yes. Daniel Sample, it was. He was catching up on some episodes. He said he's a little bit behind. And you know how some months we just can't manage to get ourselves together. And so just kind of to fill the feed a little bit, I'll throw down some radio shows or something to just which are many, many public domain radio shows.
Oh, yeah.
And one of which was a couple of Abbott and Costello shows, Abbott and Costello being a favorite comedy duo of mine. Well, Daniel Sample was catching up on some episodes, and he hit that and listened to those radio shows. And that just kind of re-sparked an interest in Abbott and Costello for him. It was something that he had watched a couple movies when he was younger. So we kind of went back and listened to a lot of the other radio shows and went back and watched a couple of the movies and really sort of rediscovered Abbott and Costello. And I just really appreciate him even coming back and letting us know that that happened, that he did that, and that, mm-hmm. you know, was thanks to our podcast. That really thrilled me. I really like seeing that. And in a large way, that is what I want this podcast to do, is to sort of bring to light some of these near forgotten pieces of our cinematic or entertainment history.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, and I know that you and I both love to listen to ourselves talk, but the reality is we probably wouldn't do this on a monthly basis if we didn't hope people would listen and be interested in it. And obviously we're interested in the topic, so we enjoy talking about it. But we make our conversations public because, you know, we want to help feed that interest in other people. So it's definitely very, very cool that he, you know, came back and let us know that that worked, that happened.
Yep, absolutely. So thank you very much, Daniel.
Yes,
and I hope you continue to enjoy him. And hopefully there's him and maybe a few others that also, you know, just listen and hear about a film and decide to check it out and maybe find an actor or a director or something that they didn't know anything about and look into more of their stuff. So
that honestly happens to me even out of this podcast. James Mason is a great example. I don't want to jump in before Christopher's ready, but I when you look through and you see, oh, this person has been in, you know, two or three things that I remember watching years and years ago, it makes me want to go back and see them again and find other things that, you know, were really great, or that, you know, contain those people and hopefully that are also great.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, let's take a real short break here and everyone, our listeners, can hear about another fine podcast that is out there. And then when we come back, we will go ahead and jump right into 1943's The Man in Gray.
The Flash Pulp Podcast. 3 to 10 minutes of fiction brought to you thrice weekly. Now it's 3 apocalypses in one.
Yeah!
Suffering from tough, stuck-on humans? Well, 20 hellish hours of suffocation in the all-encompassing web of Karwick the Spider God will get them right out. Too many brains lying around? The ravenous mouths surrounding zombie-fighting Ruby will quickly clean those up. Nosy neighbors? Infect them with the murder plague and watch as they dissolve into paranoid maniacs bent on the preemptive assassination of their friends and family. Why stop at one end of the world when you can have all three? You can find them all at flashpulp.com or search for them on iTunes.
All right, welcome back, everyone. Yes, The Man in Gray is the subject today.
That rhymes. Lydia's,
yes. Unintentionally. I'm a poet and didn't know it. Oh, my gosh.
Didn't mean to make a rhyme, but it happens to you all the time. Yeah. Oh, God. I'm so sorry. That was a Lydia original. Yeah, The Man in Gray.
Yahoo! This was a pretty interesting film just for when it was made, if nothing else. It is an English film. Filmed in London. Keep in mind that London at the time was in the threat of being bombed at any moment in the early 40s. And yet studios such as Gainsborough, where this was produced, still managed to pump out some movies. And that's pretty amazing to me.
It really is, especially when you take into account the beginning of this film, where they actually interrupt an auction that's going on for, you know, because they're contravening the blackout requirement. So it's exactly. Interesting because I guess it didn't connect for me that was actually probably going on in, you know, real life while they were filming it. They'd have to shut down because of the blackout. So
right,
very interesting.
Yeah, and this film too was a little bit of a departure. Most of the films that were being produced at the time were either comedies, which you could understand to try to, you know, lighten the mood and get people's minds off of things, or they were war pictures, which also I guess you can kind of see is you got to make your heroes the heroes. But Gainsborough started with this film making a lot of period costume dramas that became incredibly popular. And so this was like a first of many popular films out of Gainsborough. This film
and when
here
you see
stars.
It, you can see why.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And also, this movie pretty much launches the career of several of the stars. In particular, Stuart Granger. He goes on. This was his first big role, and he goes on to be a very popular leading man in a lot of drama and romantic films.
And honestly, this is one of he is one of the actors. I think he's for me the actor that sparked my interest in this movie. I love Stuart Granger. He was in one of the iterations of The Prisoner of Zenda. Not my favorite, but you will find it interesting to know that James Mason is in that too. He plays Rupert of Hensau. So they actually were in a film together later on. And Deborah Carr.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it makes you really want to watch it.
Yeah,
but I love Stuart Granger, and I think I came to really admire him because of that film. But in this film, I love him as well.
Yeah, I think him and James Mason's careers kind of intermingled back and forth. I think they co-starred in several films. I know they went up for the same role in a couple of films, and I think, one out over the other on a couple occasions.
Well, they're so different. I mean, they're
very.
And their acting and, their demeanors are very, very different. So it's interesting. It's easy to see how if you're going for a specific feel in a character, one would be an easy choice over the other. But as characters opposite one another, I really enjoy them. I felt like they are able to stand up to one another, and that's saying a lot because I feel that James Mason is a very strong, strong actor. So even though I wouldn't say that Stuart Granger is, I wouldn't consider him so much a powerful actor, but he definitely holds his presence on the stage or on film, as the case may be.
Yeah, absolutely. The other stars, as Lydia was saying, James Mason stars as Lord Rowan. We have Stuart Granger as Rokeby. Co-starring along with him is Margaret Lockwood as Hester. She's actually top billed in this.
And she deserves it. I think it's easily arguable that she deserves top billing in this film.
Yep. And then Phyllis Calvert is Clarissa. Margaret Lockwood did a fantastic job, but I was surprised that James Mason and Phyllis Calvert, being the fact that they were kind of
better known.
Maybe better known and certainly would seem like the stars of the film were not, and Margaret was the top billed, and poor Stuart Granger was like, type point sizes smaller in the credits on the credit
well,
card.
I think you mentioned that it was kind of his introduction role. If you look back at Margaret Lockwood, I didn't even recognize her in this movie because she's such a different character. She was in two fantastic wartime films. One of them, The Lady Vanishes, is a Hitchcock film, and I absolutely love it. If you get the chance to watch it, absolutely watch it. It's part of that collection of early Hitchcock stuff that he did in England. And I think we've talked about how much I love that era of his films. They're kind of simple, but so enjoyable. And then the other one that she was in was Night Train to Munich with Rex Harrison. And again, you've got a very strong actor and this very strong actress. And it's a fantastic story, great wartime drama. And you've got this. I mean, it's exactly the kind of thing that you can imagine that the English would love seeing, the British would love seeing during this war when, there's so much threat and you love seeing, this British girl, trying to escape the clutches of the Nazis. So anyway, all that to say, she had already been in a few films that were very well received, very well known. Obviously, one of them is the Hitchcock film, who even before he became the master of suspense was an incredible, writer, director. From that perspective, I'm a little bit not surprised that she got top billing, but from purely the aspect of the characters in this movie, as much as I'm impressed with everybody, she stole it to me. As much as you hate her, you love her,
Right.
She's fantastic.
Yeah. I'm not up at as much on this era of film, in British film, as you are, perhaps.
I will admit, I am,
but most of my Anglophile attraction is actually doesn't pick up until maybe you get into the 60s and 70s. I like a lot of the Hammer horror films, and then you get into a lot of the British comedies through the 70s.
My gap is right in there, so that's probably why we're able to talk about movies together. We don't know all the same stuff.
Yeah. But in many of these actors, I mean, when we come across films like this, we watch these actors, and I think, well, they seem really familiar. Now, James Mason, of course, is an actor that is like, boy, you know, he seems really familiar. He sounds really familiar. I knew him best, actually, from Walt Disney's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, where he plays Captain Nemo.
Saw that, yes.
Well, yeah, that's where I know him.
He's been in an incredible amount of stuff.
Oh, my gosh, I couldn't believe it. It's almost, I think, something like 230-some credits as an actor on IMDb.
Yeah, pretty much when I saw that he was in The Prisoner of Zenda, that was it. I was like, oh, yeah, he's cool. The Prisoner of Zenda is one of my all-time favorite stories, and I may have mentioned I like the other version a little bit more, but it's a great story anyway. So if you get the chance to watch that one too, love it.
Yeah, if you've seen him in more, I mean, because this film and in 20,000 Leagues, he is kind of the very cold and seemingly heartless individual. Does he stretch out of that in other films?
That is a really good question. Rupert Hensow is that same, you know, arrogant character. That's a very good question. But, you know, then they also had, there was a period of time where they had James Mason was doing a whole bunch of mysteries, and he was what are they called? The gumshoe. Give me the right.
Oh, right.
the private investigator is what I'm trying to say. And so I know that he has played the good guy, but I don't know that I've seen much of him playing the good guy.
That's interesting. I can't picture him doing anything else other than that steely, cold delivery. So I'd love to see him in something like a comedy or something, you know?
Again, here, Brutus in Julius Caesar in 1953. So, yeah, I can't imagine him. I don't know if he did any comedies. He was in North by Northwest.
Right.
Hitchcock.
Oh, that was hysterical.
I know. North by Northwest was one of my favorite comedies of all time. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Something hilarious about watching a guy get chased by a plane. Back to The Man in Gray, though. All that to say, we have some very strong actors in this. We started off watching it, and I have to admit, if Phyllis Calvert, the first time I watched this, I wanted to strangle her most of the time because she's just kind of clueless, and it really annoyed me. So the second time I went back, she plays a couple of characters in this movie, and I was able to see her in a kind of more intelligent role in the second viewing, and you know, it, from that perspective, she's supposed to be this very innocent, you know, naive kind of person, and I feel she played the character well.
Yeah. Don't
let her turn you off when you start watching it.
No, absolutely not.
It's worth continuing to see.
When we first see Phyllis Calvert, we see her as a Royal Navy officer attending an auction of the Rowan Estate, some sort of estate sale or auction of the Rowan property. And that's also where we meet a young, I think he was a RAF. I think he was a Royal Pilot, a Royal Air Force pilot.
Named Peter.
Peter Rokeby. And I got a kick out of, you know, he of course waits for a gentleman that was sitting right next to him to get up, and he swoops in immediately that takes a seat next to the pretty lady.
Yeah. Well, I didn't recognize him during this initial scene. I didn't realize it was Stuart Granger because I'm used to seeing him a little older. This is one of his first films, and he's so young in it. Oh my goodness, he's so young, mm-hmm. And he's got a mustache, so that's always a good disguise.
Right. But as Lydia hinted at earlier, like I was saying too, we have a naval officer and a Royal Air Force pilot. This is during World War II, and they're at this auction, and Mr. Rokeby there almost bids on a painting of the what do they call her, the Regency Regent Lord Lady Rowan.
Yes, he was the Marquis, and she was the lady. So whatever a Marquis's wife is.
Right.
It's only pronounced Marquis if you're French, I guess. Otherwise, it's Marquis.
Oh, okay. during their conversation, they were talking. He almost bids on something because he's waving his arms around. Fortunately, someone else outbids him. That was always funny at an auction to see someone wave their arms around.
And now, gentlemen, we come to what, if I may lapse into the picturesque parlance of our American cousins and allies, may be described as the high spot in today's sale.
She was the famous Regency Beauty.
Oh?
Yes, she married the man in gray.
Now, shall we open it, say, 1,000? Thank you, sir.
Yeah, I don't think the picture's so wonderful.
1,500.
Then why are you bidding for it?
I'm not.
You waved your catalogue.
From the gentleman belonging to the armed forces.
That's you.
What? Good Lord. 1,500
guineas. May I hear 1,600? Going at 1,500 guineas. Going.
1,600 over here, sir.
1,600. Thank you, sir.
Oh.
17.
Well, that would have taken my pay up to the next war but three.
18.
You dare sneeze here or you'll find you've bought a gold dinner service.
19.
We find out that, thanks to him kind of putting his foot in his mouth, that the last of the male Rowans was killed recently, and it turns out to be this young lady's brother. You kind of felt sorry for him, didn't you? He's trying to chatter up. He's trying to be all suave, and then he goes and says something about, oh, yeah, I heard the old guy bit it over at Dunkirk.
Yeah. I really enjoy this, because obviously at first we don't know who this young woman is. And then, they say, oh, well, the thing I wanted to bid on, we blackout is here, so we have to shut off the lights. But, save us a couple of seats. And she says, oh, save one for this man. And he says his name. And then the auctioneer says, oh, yes, Lady Rowan. And he kind of pales.
Yes.
I love those introductions, because it didn't occur to me, of course, at first I wasn't very familiar with Phyllis Calvert, so I didn't realize that was her. But mm-hmm. I love those moments, those awkward what do they call them? Those things.
Yeah, moments. Awkward moments,
meet
I think,
cute.
Works.
That's what it's called, those awkward meet cute.
They, through their discussion, they realize that their families are somewhat intertwined. She is a Rowan, and supposedly, according to his mother's tales, one of his ancestors used to be a lover of the old lady Rowan.
Of the old lady Rowan. That sounds awful.
Well, I'm trying to think of how the best to describe her, because we have a lady Rowan. He's talking to Mrs. Rowan, or Miss Rowan.
The previous lady Rowan.
Yes.
And interestingly, they both share the same first name, too. They're both Clarissa Rowan. So,
yep.
Yes, but speaking of course, his ancestor was supposedly in love with the previous lady Clarissa Rowan.
Yes. And at that point, they leave the auction, and we actually go back to what they call the Regency period, is what I've seen it described. And this is the period between 1811 and 1820 in England, and that's where most of the rest of the film is set. And this is where we start out at, Miss Patchett's School for Girls, and where we meet a young Clarissa, who is a student, and Hester Shaw, a student teacher, I think, is how she comes into play.
Young ladies, I bring you a new companion. Perhaps companion is hardly the word, as Miss Shaw will in due course be engaged as a junior teacher. Nevertheless, I trust that you will welcome her as if she received the same advantages as yourselves.
Have you traveled far, Miss Shaw?
From Manchester.
Ah, one of the Manchester Shaws.
You brought your clogs, will you?
I don't wear clogs, nor yet a shawl over my head. It isn't the custom.
It's Clarissa!
Oh, Clarissa!
Who is Clarissa?
Why, she's Clarissa, Paula Border.
She's the Honourable Clarissa Richmond, daughter of the late Lord Carey. Which accounts for her popularity, I imagine.
Not at all. She's both lovely and amiable. Even you, miss, will find her so.
Our sweets for all, so take your turn, everybody. Here we are, Jane.
Oh,
Louisa. Dorothy. Who'd like this one?
One for you, and the last one for you. Now nobody's left out. I've even remembered myself.
I'm Clarissa Richmond. Will you have a sugared violet?
No, thank you. I don't care for
sugary things.
Are you cold, Clarissa?
No, somebody walked over my grave. Come and show me the things you bought.
Marjorie, bring the parcels.
Yes, compared to Clarissa, who when she shows up, everyone's like, oh, Clarissa's here. Clarissa's here. Oh, she's so wonderful and nice and kind.
She's Clarissa.
Yeah, Hester does not take to Clarissa very much. Hester has apparently lived a rather hard life. She's always had to kind of scrimp and scratch to survive, apparently, and doesn't take kindly to Clarissa, who she feels has had a pampered life, I suppose. But Clarissa is apparently friends to everybody. She is determined to make this woman like her and to make her best friend.
Because she's pretty. That's yeah. What you do with pretty girls. You have to be friends with them or you have to hate them.
Exactly, yeah.
I just lost half of our listeners. Sorry, girls.
Now, I will admit, this whole time through the school is probably the hardest part of this film to get through. But, I mean, it's an important bit of foreshadowing, but it is nothing but foreshadowing. It is like laying down sort of the foundation of their relationship. And certainly, you get the beginnings. You start seeing how... I think, how'd you describe how innocent, a little clueless Clarissa is mm-hmm. at this point, whereas Hester is definitely a little bit more streetwise. And, you know, you can see the gears turning in Hester's head all the time, while Clarissa, you just think, is probably imagining rainbows and daisies. Yeah,
exactly, unicorns. And Christopher, I'm going to have a little more insight on this than you are, and I have the unique perspective of not only being a girl, but also being a massive, massive fan of Jane Austen. I love all of Jane Austen's novels. I've read them. I love Jane Eyre. I love Northanger Abbey. And I feel like those three books in particular probably had a very huge influence on Eleanor Smith, the writer of the novel from which this movie came. In fact, if you've ever read, I'm going to launch into a little bit of a soapbox. If you've ever read Aragon, you've come back to about five different books and genres of dragon lore that obviously were borrowed from heavily in creating that story. And I felt the same way when I was watching the school segment of The Man in Grey. I felt like almost 100% of it was taken almost verbatim from Jane Austen, from Jane Eyre, from Northanger Abbey. And especially if you have read Northanger Abbey, you know that during this time period, Gothic novels were a huge trend. So when you hear the girls talking to each other in the dormitory room, and they're saying, "Oh, it turns out there was a nun walled up the whole time." You know, that's a throwback to those Gothic novels of the 17 and 1800s. And so these girls are very much engaged in that culture where it's all very dramatic, and keeping a journal was the thing that ladies did. You know, so you see Clarissa keeping this journal through the whole thing, which is a very period kind of thing to do. So really, when you're watching this section, if you are familiar with that, you know, the novels of the late 17, early 1800s, you're going to see a lady who was writing this novel who was a fan of those books. You're going to see a lot heavily borrowed from that. So yes, there, even the point to where they have a gypsy woman come in and the gypsy woman is reading their palms. And mm-hmm. that's such a throwback to Jane Eyre. All of it, boom, in about a 5-minute segment, you're like, well, pretty much this is all of our favorite novels from that era. So that's a little bit of history for you guys out there that probably haven't gotten as big into Jane Eyre, Jane Austen. But if knowing that, if you go back and watch it again, then you'll kind of go, okay, so this is what's going on, is this is that era when women were basically just meant to be pretty things to look at. That ladies did not serve any practical purpose except for procreation. And so these girls, they're not allowed to throw snowballs. They're not allowed to talk loud. They have to have the lights out at a certain time, unless they're praying, of course. You know, mm-hmm. this is all kind of setting that stage, saying this is how these girls are raised, and also giving you an idea of how innocent most of these girls are, to kind of give you a contrast of how different Hester is, as we find out by her complete Lydia Bennett move of running away with a soldier. And back to the story.
Right. Well, you know, you mentioned the gypsy that comes through and starts reading the fortune. You don't know it the first time you watch this film, but the gypsy pretty much tells you everything that's going to happen. You almost don't have to watch the rest of the film.
It's an M. Night Shyamalan movie. It's that moment in an M. Night Shyamalan movie where they look down the camera lens and they say, I see dead people. That's this moment, yeah. You know everything's going to happen after this. Everything from the man in gray to he's not the one for you and there'll be men from across the sea. Every moment of it is right here.
Here's a pretty fortune. Jewels, satins, gold, marriage, yes, a rich one. You'll want for nothing. I see you in a splendid coach. You're with a man wearing grey.
Shall I marry him?
You will, but he's not the one for you. Here's your man. He comes from over the sea.
What is it?
Women isn't lucky to you, my pretty. Never make no friends of women. Here's one who will arm you. Remember my words. I warned you solemn. Never make no friends of women.
Yeah, and I think there's even, don't make friends of women. And I mean, it's all there.
Women folk will do you no good. Women folk ain't lucky for you. Don't make no friends of no women.
But yeah, as you do mention, they do. Clarissa and Hester do indeed strike up a friendship. Clarissa pretty much forces it on her, but Hester even admits that Clarissa means more to her than anybody has. I think at this point, whether or not she's telling the truth, anyone's guess at this point. I think in the school, at least at that time, she is honest about it.
I think she
does have a friendship for Clarissa.
The fact that she gives her a gift at this point and she says, you better take it quick because I'm not often generous.
Right.
I think that right there is the proof that, she does. This is a girl that doesn't have much in the world, but she knows she's going to leave. And so she does, have that moment of generosity and give something away to her friend. And so I think, at that moment she does. But then from the very beginning, she says, once we have left school, once we leave school, our positions are different. We're not going to be friends anymore.
Right. Well, Hester is cast out of the school after she, how did the school marm describe it?
This is the most solemn moment in the history of this school. When a young lady tarnishes that beautiful but brittle jewel, her reputation, which it is her duty to preserve, preferably before life itself. Then I hazard, if you cannot control yourself, you had better leave the room.
Yes, ma'am. No, I'm going to be sick.
Miss Shaw has disgraced her sex. Her name must never again be mentioned in this house.
Perhaps, ma'am, if she'd received kinder treatment here, she would not have taken this step.
It is the duty of every well-disposed young woman to try and secure a creditable establishment. Miss Shaw has eloped with a perilous ensign. I had hoped, my dear Miss Richmond, that this experience would have taught you to form your friendships more prudently in future.
Hester will always be my dearest friend, and I won't remain in a house where her name may not be mentioned.
Clarissa.
I shall write and ask Lady Mar to take me away.
But Clarissa, you cannot leave school until you have completed your education. Your harp, my love. You're Italian.
I shall not speak Italian in my establishment.
She runs away with the soldier. Again, very Lydia Bennett move. Any of you girls that have read Jane Austen, you know exactly what I'm talking about. If you happen to watch that horrible version of one of my favorite books ever, another soapbox there. Sorry, we're in that era. But if you've watched Pride and Prejudice, hopefully you've seen the good one with Colin Firth and Jennifer Ely. But you know that Lydia Bennett also runs away with the soldier, and it's this huge, horrible downfalling, not only for the girl herself, but also for her family and anybody that knows her. And basically, once a girl runs away with somebody to get married without, permission or thought for her fortune or, taking care of her home or whatever, then that's when it becomes this huge disgrace. And so that's basically what's happened. Nobody's allowed to talk to her anymore because
her name is not allowed to be mentioned in the school.
She's basically considered a loose woman at this point.
Exactly. Yes. Cause you can throw in a little double entendre if you want to the school marm's Miss Patchett's speech, because she says that she has tarnished her jewel, her reputation.
Oh yeah. Well, there's no mistake. She's saying exactly what it sounds like. She's inferring. She's run away with a soldier, and if you spend a night away from school with a man, it's just assumed that the worst has happened.
Well, Clarissa moves to London, where she quickly becomes the belle of the social circles, thanks to, I think she moves in with her aunt, I think.
I believe it's her godmother, but it godmother? Might also be okay. her aunt.
Yeah. And it is at one of these balls that the elder Lady Rowan decides that she would be suitable to be his wife, because frankly he needs an heir and she doesn't really care about love, relationships, or anything. She figures her husband made the same decision years ago, and it's time for the young Mr. Rowan to do the same.
Mm-hmm. Like you do.
Like you do. So, yes, he, if you can call it proposing.
I've come to ask for your hand in marriage.
Marriage? But that's absurd. You don't even like me.
If that were so, I should be hardly making this application.
But surely. Oh, my. Is this an offer?
It is.
Sir, my lord, I mean, I thank you. I'm very sensible of the honor that you do me, but in this matter, my inclinations cannot be my only guide. And before I answer your application, I must consult my guardian.
Were you taught that at school?
Yes.
I've already applied to Lady Mar. The matter rests entirely with yourself.
Oh. Well, I don't understand why you want to marry me. We scarcely know each other.
That can be remedied. May I call for you tomorrow in my caracal?
Yes. I should enjoy that. I've always wanted to ride in a caracal.
It's settled then. Shall we say 3 o'clock?
Yes.
To her, it sounded more like a, hell, hello, yes, you're going to marry me. I've already set it up with your aunt, so you're all good.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to come pick you up tomorrow. We're going to go on a carriage ride. Of course, she doesn't know what a carriage ride means.
Boom.
Oh, no. In these days, a carriage ride for a lady to be seen in public alone with a man without a chaperone or a guardian basically meant they were engaged. He was stood by the family with her safety and security to the point where it was just generally accepted that they were going to be married.
Yes. And they do indeed get married. And she quickly finds out that, and he admits, and he freely admits, that the only reason he married her was that he needs an heir.
And I think he used the word broodmare.
He uses it, I think, in discussion with his mother.
And then later, I believe he actually says, well, actually, I'm not confident he says it to Clarice, but he definitely says, I have to have an heir. And she says, that's the only reason you married me. And he said, yes.
Yeah, he said, that's all I ask of you.
And then after that, you're free to go. You can go do what you want,
Free to go. Just we will we'll move back to the home in London. We'll each live our lives and do as we you can do as you please, and with permission I will do the, and if it's all right with you, I'll do the same. Yeah.
Go where you like, see who you want, and we won't bother each other.
Exactly. Which is exactly what they do for the next apparently 4 years, according to Clarissa's journal. she does give birth to a son, of which she doesn't see much of. She's kind of lamenting the fact that she's been able to neither be really a wife or a mother in all this time. She continues to, I guess, live the fraud of this life.
Yeah, there's an interesting kind of exchange here when she's having her portrait painted, the same portrait that she's mm-hmm. selling at the beginning. And she's asking the painter if her little boy looks as beautiful as he does in the photo, or rather the portrait.
Mr. Lawrence, is my little boy really as pretty as that?
Your ladyship should be the better judge.
I scarcely see him. My husband insists that he stays at Rowan Castle.
And you do not care for Rowan Castle.
I think it's an odious place. Didn't you think so when you were there?
Rather too large for comfort.
Far too large. Dear, I'll tell you a strange thing. Whatever room you may go into, you'll certainly find my mother-in-law playing bazique with the curate.
Yes, I observed that.
You paint me as a happy mother. I'm not very happy. I'm scarcely a mother. The child hardly knows me. When he's 5, he's to have a tutor. After that, he's to go to Eton. He's never really been mine. And yet I'm to smile because I'm supposed to be happy.
No, Lady Rowan, you smile because you're fortunate.
Aren't they the same thing?
A dairymaid can be happy, but she's not obliged to smile when she's wretched. The fortunate must pay their debt. A great lady must never be seen without a smile.
Yeah, how do you like that? She's having her portrait painted with her son.
And he's not in the room. He's not even in the house.
In the room, yep. Yeah.
And I think that was very common back in this time. I think that the separation of the husband and wife was a very common thing, especially among, you know, elevated social status. But you know, at this point, she's having this conversation. She says, "You're painting me like I look happy. You know, am I supposed to look happy?" Mm-hmm. And basically, the painter tells her, "You know, it's your duty as a person of means to look happy all the time. That's your only duty, basically." But it's interesting if you listen to their exchange. Just that philosophy of that time period is very poignant.
Well, the next scene, I think it is, we see Clarissa playing cards with a group of friends, and an old friend from school, I believe it was, shows up and shows her an ad that she had picked up for a play that's playing in a nearby town, one of the stars is a Hester, Barbary or something, Barbary. I believe. It was Barbary, thank
Hester
you.
Hester Barbary. This is Hester Barbary.
And it must be her, because she ran off with a soldier named Barbary, so it must be her. So Clarissa heads off to try to catch this play to try to meet up with her friend. On her way to this town, her coach is stopped by a bit of a rogue who apparently was thrown from his horse, or his horse fell in a ditch or something like that, and he insists that they give him a ride.
He was thrown from his horse and he landed in a gorse bush. His horse fell in a ditch. Thanks. The mental image of a horse falling in a ditch. Keep going.
Let's see. Anyway, this fellow turns out to be Mr. Rokeby himself. She doesn't know it at the time, but he forces his way into her coach and then proceeds to pretty much have a good time. Playfully threatening.
He forces his way into her coach and then has a good time. Really.
That does sound bad, doesn't
does
it?
Does sound bad. But
how
no,
would you describe it?
I would say that he demands at gunpoint a ride to the town to which they're already going. And then upon arriving there, discloses that his guns are no more than sticks. And his mother told him never to point a gun at a lady.
Exactly. But on the way, he does sort of playfully threatening the two ladies that are in the coach, which I kind of enjoyed. I got a kick out of Clarissa's little handmaiden there. At one point, he kind of looks at her and gives her a wink. Oh, my lady.
I did. I appreciated Clarissa's composure during this point, though. She doesn't what I would have expected her to do. She doesn't get flighty and faint or anything like that, but she kind of gives him a little bit of his own back. And when he initially stops their coach and he asks the coachman a question, she says, "You will address yourself to me, sir." You know, and I love it that you can tell that even though she was a schoolgirl and young and naive going into this marriage, she has kind of come into her own a little bit.
I like that she does that. "You will, address me, sir." And then, it's like at that moment she was like, "Ooh, why did I say that?" She kind of sits back as he walks up. It's like, whoops.
Maybe not.
Yeah. Well, once they get to the play, they discover that that gentleman that they gave a ride to is indeed the
foreign parts man. I got to back it up. So as he climbs out of the coach, he says, "You know, I thank you very much for your hospitality," and he mooches her. He lays a big old fat one on her.
Oh yeah, he does.
So much more romantically than I expressed it.
Oh, yeah. And she is quite flustered by it, but not necessarily in a bad way.
Yeah, her handmaiden says, "Oh, did you ever know such impudence?" She says, "No, no." It's kind of, "Ooh, but I wish I had," you know.
Exactly. Well, think about, you know, for the last 4 or 5 years of her life, she's been in a, you know, a loveless marriage
not the most gentle of creatures, let's put it that way.
Exactly.
She hasn't really even enjoyed what little affection she has now.
Well, upon arriving and viewing the play, they do see that it is indeed Hester that is starring in the play, and co-starring along with her is none other than this rogue that stopped him on the road.
This is one of my favorite scenes, and Christopher, I know you were going to bring it up, but I'm going to beat you to it. I love this whole scene. It's if you've ever seen Stage Beauty with Billy, I can't think of his last name, and Claire Danes, it is centered around this scene in Othello where Othello kills Ophelia. I'm using the wrong name. where Othello kills his wife, who Desdemona. And they do that scene in The Man in Grey, but in The Man in Grey, while they're doing this whole scene, in between the lines, they're carrying a completely different conversation on.
Yes, I loved it.
It's wonderful. And it's between Stuart Granger and Margaret Locke.
Who's there? Othello.
Aye, Desdemona. Who's in the stage box, you know?
Will you come to bed, my lord, the Marchioness of Rouen?
Have you prayed tonight, Desdemona?
Aye, my lord.
I never saw such loveliness in my life. And forfend, I will not kill thy soul.
Talk you of killing?
Aye. I do. How do you know her?
Kill me tomorrow. Let me live tonight. I was at school with her.
Nay, if you strive.
You were at school with her.
But half an hour, I tell you, I was.
Being done, there is no pause. It's the biggest lie you ever told.
While I say one prayer, I have lived all my life with scum like you.
What?
That's enough, you.
Oh, she's my schoolmate. Oh, you never told such a lie in your life. You never went to school. You know, they go back and forth through the whole thing. So they say the line, you know, and they project it, and then they have this, you know, conversation under the breath. And you can tell they don't like each other, which makes it even more fun. And then at the very end, when he's supposed to be killing her, you know, he puts the pillow over her face and he says, now answer back if you can. I love that. That whole exchange where you can tell that they're just butting heads the whole time. It totally cracks me up.
Yeah, it was really good. I loved it. See, after the play, Clarissa and Hester reunite, and Hester tells Clarissa of her husband's death and her state of affairs, meaning she's poor and destitute, pretty much.
Although that's an accurate way to put it, her state of affairs. But yes,
yeah.
She feeds Clarissa this line about, oh, he died in my arms, and we loved each other so much.
Mm-hmm.
Clarissa, you know, seized with compassion, says, well, you're coming back to London with me and you're going to be my little boy's nanny.
Or exactly.
Governess.
Yes. I had nanny in my notes too, but they used a fancier word.
Yeah. Back in those days, it was governess, yes. And the governess is actually supposed to help teach the child. I think a nanny is religious there for, you know, well-being.
Well, back in London, Clarissa takes Hester with her and they go back to London, and she goes down to discuss it with Rowan, and immediately he says no, that wasn't going to happen. But then Hester makes her entrance, and of course in a very beautiful dress that she I guess found hanging in a closet.
I think that Clarissa was going to give it to her, and she says, oh, you can't keep things, but she puts it on real quickly.
Yes, exactly. And goes down, and immediately Lord Rowan takes one look at her and says, no, you won't be working here, but you can stay as Clarissa's companion, I believe it is. Yeah, she needs a friend.
Stay as long as you like.
Exactly.
Well, and it is interesting. Earlier in the movie, you even hear when, before he proposes to Clarissa, he's having this conversation with his mother where he says, you know, oh, I don't want one of these innocent girls that are just, you know, flopping around, basically. That's not what he says, but, you know, imagine something flopping around, and that's kind of what they do. And he says, I'm not interested in it, you know, but if you let me have a woman, you know, who's intelligent and, you know, strong-willed, then I could, you know, shield her from any scandal, you know. And his mother says, no, it has to be somebody that's pure, you know. And you really can see that dichotomy between Clarissa and Hester. You know, Clarissa is this innocent, foppish, is that the word I want? Anyway, she's this innocent, you know, creature that believes in people. And then you have Hester, who's just, you know, strong-willed and going to do whatever she has to get ahead in life.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So he's basically looking at exactly what he's always wanted.
Exactly. And it's no surprise that they quickly begin an affair in the household.
Dun-dun-dun.
Dun-dun-dun. Well, sometime later, Clarissa and Rokeby meet up again. They happen to be – she goes to a horse race along with Rowan and Hester. And lo and behold, Rokeby is there. He's a he's doing barking at a like a sideshow or something.
He is. He's a barker at a sideshow.
Yeah. And they reunite, and of course – strike up a little conversation, and there's obviously some attraction between the two. They seem to get along quite well. And Hester notices this, and she manages to sort of begin the weaving of a little bit of a machination and gets him a position as librarian in the Rowan estate.
In fact, she lies to him and implies that it was Clarissa's idea all along. Of course, when he goes there, he finds out she had nothing to do with it. She had no idea, but can't bring himself to leave.
Exactly. Because he is attracted to Clarissa, and he does like the idea of being near to her. And it isn't long before those two begin.
The girl.
Yeah.
Well, now, and I'm going to argue with you. I don't believe there's an affair in the typical sense going on here. There is in the romantic sense. But you can tell that where Hester and Rowan are these people that just engage in whatever desires they want, it's like Rokeby and Clarissa have that kind of higher elevated sense of moral, propriety. So even though, yes, they are making love to one another in the classical sense, of course, there's sweet nothings whispered and all of that kind of thing, you don't see a whole lot of, falling all over each other. They're not in each other's bedrooms the way that you see that Clarissa, or I'm sorry, the way that you see that Hester and Rowan are.
Right. And I think at this point, this is about the point where the film actually really gets good. Up to this point, I feel like I'm just sort of having to slog through all the buildup. And then from here, this is when I really started enjoying the film.
Yeah, you're a guy.
I am a guy.
This is a romantic movie. And I think especially for that sort of sensibility where you are drawn, where you appreciate that kind of, I don't want to say drawn out, but that sort of more innocent love, that less about, sexual inclination and more about, emotional involvement. This is a fun movie to watch even up to this point. I think even if you were to take a look at the characters of Clarissa and Hester and really it's their dynamic, upon watching it the second time, there's so much going on between those two where you can just see that over and over Clarissa is just deceiving herself. And, you even see where Hester tells her, I'm not going to be friends with you. I'm not going to help you. And, the whole time, the dynamic between them is fascinating to me.
Yeah, but I think at this point, though, this is where I kind of want to stop the synopsis.
Yeah, I agree.
Because, I don't really want to spoil the last half of the film. Mm-hmm. What you realize, and I think you don't necessarily realize it through the first half, but after watching the second half, and then you look at it as a whole, it's a very intelligent script because you need everything that, as I described, you slog through, and you feel a little differently.
Yes.
You feel a little differently, but you need all of that to understand everything that goes on from this point forward. Mm-hmm.
I think so.
And understand why people act the way they do and why they don't see what should be, to you and I, maybe, obvious.
As outside observers, absolutely.
Exactly. So I don't know. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about the film? I mean, performance-wise, I think, like you were saying and we were both saying earlier, the acting is just incredible, I think.
I think it's exceptional. I think as far as older films and especially black and white films are concerned, this as being an emotional drama, I think it does compare with Jane Eyre. Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights, those kind of period romance novels, even though I know people have a tendency to think of them as, boring, antiquated, to me, they're some of the best writing that has ever been brought into existence in the English language. So the character studies in that type of novel are so fascinating. And I feel like there's a lot of that that goes on in this movie. So, if you just hate black and white films, we're probably not going to change your mind on this one. But if you can appreciate a strong script and some great acting, then you're going to enjoy this.
Absolutely. I feel like we need to put some sort of a little bit of a warning maybe on it. This is a 1940s film, and then it's a period drama on top of that, going back to the early 1800s. There is some less than favorable sort of stereotype and descriptors used for certain peoples throughout the film. We do have young Toby, which a young black boy who becomes Clarissa's, I don't know, she keeps him on.
Kind of her valet. Yeah, again, Britishism.
Yes.
A valet. But interestingly, and this is totally unrelated to the movie, but this is the kid that never ages.
this movie is
spanned over 4 to 6 years. And he never changes. I know that's just a factor of the fact that, of course, this is a movie that was filmed in a matter of a few months, you know. So, of course, he doesn't really age, but it made me laugh a little bit.
Yeah, I got a kick out of that myself. But, yeah, they do use words that in today's world would be frowned upon. Being used in a film, certainly by any of these actors. So
apparently I'm a little obtuse when it comes to that, because I didn't notice. But then again, I'll be fair, I do read period novels from this era. So to me, the verbiage that they use to me is not offensive. It's a period verbiage. It's not necessarily. So right. Just be aware that they're using some period verbiage. And
exactly.
Nothing... You know, nothing in the vein of Uncle Tom's Cabin or anything like that. But do be, you know, I suppose you could be aware that there's the views expressed in this film are not reflective of the views of the reviewers on Orphan Entertainment. But I don't think, I think any intelligent person watching this is going to understand that this is, you know, a period film and not take it as intended to be offensive.
Yep, absolutely. No, and I don't think it was ever meant to be offensive, and none of the language is, I think, directed at anybody in an offensive manner. It is just used as a description, I suppose, and you know, a description that, in, like I said, in today's world would be not necessarily appreciated.
Yeah, basically not PC.
Yes, but like I said, for me, the last half of the film I found really enjoyable. First half of the film I found a little hard to get through, but overall, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I will say that the first time I watched it, which was not the watching of scrutiny that I did. The second time I watched it, I paid more attention. The first time, you know, when I was kind of giving it a cursory viewing, there were, you know, like I mentioned, Clarissa bothered me the first time I watched it. The second time I watched it, I really enjoyed it. But, you know, and near the end, there's a whole scene where I thought, oh, God, we have to go through this, you know, really?
Yeah.
But the second time watching it, it seemed extremely well paced. It seemed perfectly suited to the situation. You know, so if you watch it one time and you're not just crazy about it, maybe give it a second watch and you might be surprised by what you see the second time around.
All right, well, what kind of rating do you think you would give The Man in Gray?
You know, I have to give it 5 ovals. For the time period that it was in, I think that the production values are very, very good. I think the acting is just phenomenal. And even, you know, we mentioned especially that one scene where they're doing Othello. The script and the dialogue and the storyline, I think, is just a very strong story. I'm going to give it 5.
Wow.
Bearing in mind, of course, that it's a 1943 film, and I've seen several, and this to me stands out as one of the best.
And so
it is listed in several lists of, you know, top 1000 movies or, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that stands. I think that as far as my taste goes and my preferences, I very much enjoyed it.
Oh, fantastic. So 5 out of 5 for you, huh?
You know, I want to compare it to films of its own era and actors of its own era, and special effects of its own era, you know, all of that, then yes, I would definitely give it a 5. Now, I'm interested to hear yours.
All right. Well, I'm going to split it right down the middle. I'm only going to give it a 3. And it's not because I, you know, obviously the quality of the film is superb. Like I said, the acting was really good. The story ended up being incredibly intelligent. None of that goes against it. It was just, I think when it boils down to it, it was really just not my kind of film. The fact that I felt like I had to force myself through the first half to get to the part that I liked, you know, it just, even though I understand that you need it all, I still feel like, ah, I have to sit through this to get through the, you know, and even when I sat down to try to do a little bit of a rewatch, I didn't get a chance to watch it like I usually do most of these films, you know, the second viewing as much, I still felt, yeah, but that was the part that I had to go through the most to get any kind of notes is through the first half. I'm like, ah, I got to sit through that, you know, can I skip to the end?
Well, so for that reason, I will say that if it had ended a little earlier, and you know what I mean, because you've seen the film, if it had ended a little sooner, it would have received a much lower rating from me. Due to my personal preferences in a certain cinematographic technique, cinematography technique that, you know, where it makes it a completely different kind of movie. And, I don't want to give too much away, but let's just say if it had ended a little earlier, I would have given it a much lower rating, but, I probably would have given it a 3 or a 4, but I feel that this is just one of those movies that I know I'll go back to. I will watch this movie again. And, obviously I've already watched it twice, and I'll watch it again just for my own enjoyment.
Yep. Well, that's
for me, that's a 5. I respect your opinion, though.
And I mentioned,
I'm a girl. I love Jane Austen. So it would make sense for me to want to give this a higher rating than for you.
Okay, and I will say this, though. It is a type of film that at some point I think I will try to sit through and rewatch it. And maybe because I would be rewatching it without the idea of reviewing it, that I would probably rewatch it and, again, watch it beginning to end, because I didn't get a chance to really sit down and watch this from beginning to end. I had to watch it for a little while, and I had to stop it, and then I had to pick it up and finish it. And so maybe if I sat down and was actually able to watch it from beginning to end, my view might change.
It might be a little more coherent for you, yeah, or cohesive.
Exactly. And, you know, maybe I will I'll find a little bit more. But just for the type of film and for me, yeah, I don't want to give it a bad rating, but I just can't give it a great rating either. So I'm just out of fairness, so I'm just going to split it down the middle.
Yeah, so for the sake of argument, if you were – doing an Academy Awards on it and you were giving it OFLs for acting, you'd have 4 or 5 OFLs. If you're giving OFLs for story, you would give it maybe 2 or 3. Or direction.
Oh, you're making it hard on me now.
Well, no, I'm trying to simplify. Yeah. I mean, your biggest, if I understand correctly, your biggest bone to pick with this movie is that you weren't engaged by the storyline. The acting was
correct.
Good. The dialogue was good as far as you were concerned. You were happy with the beginning, the end of it. You know, it. But really the biggest thing is it just didn't engage you as a topic.
Exactly. At least not in the beginning. And like I said, I think once the real meat of the plot really starts taking hold in the second half, I was much more interested. And I wasn't, as you use the term, engaged in the first part of the film.
Yeah, and that's fair. I'm definitely not arguing with a 3 stars. You know, that's part of what's great about, I think, this podcast is that Christopher and I have very, very different film backgrounds and different interests in film, I think. So while we're able to enjoy the same kind of film, you know, I think our tastes tend in different directions. And so it's great because, you know, people will be able to figure out, well, you know what, I tend to agree more with Christopher, I tend to agree more with Lydia. Or I tend to think that they're both crazy, you know, and then you can kind of gauge what you want to watch based on that. And, or, you know, watch something and say, you know, I'm kind of surprised. I thought I'd agree with, you know, Lydia, but I agree with Christopher. So no, I think it's great for us to not give the same rating to movies because it gives people a better idea of what they may or may not like about it.
Yeah, I mean, this is only the third film that we've actually put a rating to, but it was the first time that I think we've been this far apart in our ratings. So
yeah, definitely.
It was, well, it was bound to happen, better to happen sooner, you know.
Well, and I think this is a great movie for it to happen on because it is a very taste specific movie, I think. I think, it's a period movie. It's an old movie. It's black and white. It's a different type of acting than we have now. So I think, I think it's a really good one to kind of show where our tastes lie. And also, you know, I think that depending on what you're rating it compared to, it could have a very high rating or a very low rating. But again, I think that diversity is part of what is going to benefit our listeners. Do you agree with listeners? This is where you check into Facebook and say, I agree with Lydia. I think you guys should disagree more often and argue. Or, you know, please go to Facebook and tell us that we're crazy or that we're awesome, whichever you like. but no, so I think this one, split down the middle, we give it an overall 4.
Well, then I think that will do it. I want to thank all the listeners for joining us once again. I hope you continue to download future episodes of Orphan Entertainment. And, of course, you can do that by subscribing through iTunes. Swing by our Facebook page and let us know, if you watch this film, what you think of The Man in Gray. Bye, everybody.
Bye.